Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC empowers you to experience Jewish paths toward a life of joy, purpose, and meaning through innovative Jewish learning and wellness programs, community building, and initiatives to develop the next generation of Jewish leaders. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 272, Why Jewish Fiction? Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rothberg.
And today we are doing the second episode that is framing a series of episodes that we're going to be doing over the months ahead. It's going to be interspersed with other series that we're doing. And this interspersed series is about new Jewish books that are coming out. Most of them are fiction, not all. And we're looking at some of the new ideas that are coming out in Jewish fiction and nonfiction, and also the impulse to write a Jewish book. We're looking at that as a form of Jewish creativity, Jewish creation that accords with a lot of what we've been looking at here in Judaism Unbound over the years. A lot of times that gets looked at as organizations, but there are other ways to manifest that kind of Jewish creativity and that kind of new thinking that this podcast is all about. And so this series of episodes is going to be looking at how that manifests in the writing of books. Last week, we talked to Sophia Pasternak and Amy Lucido about writing books for young readers. And our guest today, David Hirschberg, is writing books for older readers, otherwise known as adults. His latest book, Jacobo's Rainbow, comes out this coming Tuesday, May 4th. And it's a historical novel set primarily in New Mexico during the period of the free speech student protest movement and the Vietnam War. It tells the story of Jacobo Toledano, an outsider with a hidden past, and I don't want to reveal much more than that and spoil the book for you. The author of Jacobo's Rainbow, who we know as David Hirschberg, actually writes under a pseudonym, which is a question that we're going to discuss in our conversation today. Before turning to writing, this pseudonymous author was an entrepreneur in the biotech field. His first novel, My Mother's Son, won 9 different literary awards, including the Gold Medal for Regional Fiction in the 2018 Independent Publisher Book Awards, and the winner of the Best Regional Fiction from the 2018 National Indie Excellence Awards. Both books are published by Fig Tree Books, and you can buy them wherever books are sold. Now, before we jump into the episode, a quick program note. At the end of today's episode, after we conclude the interview, we are going to be doing the first answer to a listener question. Lex is going to be answering a listener question. Remember, a few weeks ago, we mentioned that as a reward for listeners who contribute $5 on a recurring monthly basis or folks who contribute $60 or more annually, we'll have the opportunity to send in questions that we will answer on the air. So we're excited to have our first one coming up. And with that, let's turn to our interview with David Hirschberg. David Hirschberg, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be with both of you.
Well, we're starting this kind of series, which is distributed through the next few months, where we're talking to a number of authors of fiction from a Jewish perspective or from a Jewish point of view or about the Jewish experience. Last week, we talked to some folks who are earlier in their lives who are writing fiction. And this week, we're talking with you, who is somebody who came to write fiction after a long career as an entrepreneur. I'm wondering a little bit if you could talk about where that impulse to write fiction comes from at this stage of your life and what you're trying to do by now becoming a novelist.
I spent a career in biotech developing drugs, and about 4 or 5 years ago, I decided that I needed something as a second act, and I had always wanted to write, and fiction was what I had wanted to write. And so I decided to do something, and I wrote a novel. And when I was finished with it, I was very proud, and then I did probably the best thing I've ever done. I deleted it. It was 124,000 words, and out of that, between 1,500 and 1,800 words were preserved. And those preserved words went into my first book called My Mother's Son, which came out 3 years ago. The decision to write was one that if I didn't start doing it, I would have one of these regrets later on where I would say, oh, I could have done this. I'm so disappointed I didn't do that. And the worst thing that would happen since I did it on my own was it wouldn't be very good and no one else would know. And I wouldn't suffer any of the negative consequences. I was lucky when I sent chapters around to people who said they liked it very much, and they continued to push me to write. And that was at the same time I was leaving my last CEO job in biotech. And so now I have more time to write. Although I'm advising a few companies now, it doesn't take too much time. So I spend most of my time writing.
Well, I have a follow-up question, but before I get to it, I just want to check. When you say that you deleted it, did you actually press delete and it's gone? Or does that just mean it's in a drawer somewhere?
No, I wanted to delete it because the last thing I wanted was to find out, after I'm gone, that somebody finds a manuscript and says, my God, this was awful. And I didn't want to have anybody find that, look at it, review it, and somehow taint a legacy that I had with some of the writing that I thought was good. So it is physically gone, and I had absolutely no regrets about doing that.
Can you talk a little bit about, especially as somebody who is coming to this after living many years, and I don't mean by that that you're an Alterkacher, I mean by that that you're somebody who's not just jumping into this profession of fiction writing because, you know, it's their burning passion when they're a young person and they're not necessarily thinking about all these questions when they start, or I imagine that many aren't. It's like, what is it that you're trying to do when you write fiction? In other words, if you have thoughts, why doesn't one write them as nonfiction? You know, what is it that in the impulse to write fiction is going on? And how do you come at that process? Again, as somebody who has spent a whole life thinking about how do I want to say what I'm trying to say? How do you come at fiction from that perspective?
So one of the things that I wanted to do was to relate to what's going on today in the United States. And if I were to do that, even in a fiction book, the entire discussion about what's going on today would be clouded by some sort of political filter. I didn't want to do that. So I've set all of my books, and there are three, one, My Mother's Son, that came out 3 years ago, one that's just out now called Jacobo's Rainbow, and one that I hope to have out in about 18 months called A Bronx Cheer. But in the case of My Mother's Son, I wanted to talk about a lot of the issues that are going on today. And by setting it in 1952, I allow the reader to say, this is an interesting story. And only when he or she is finished do they say, oh my God, this is a metaphor for what's going on today. The reviewers for My Mother's Son talked about the issues that took place in 1952, and they then themselves said, this is a metaphor for what's going on today. In Jacobo's Rainbow, it's about the free speech movement, the Freedom Summer, and the Vietnam War, the summer of 1964 going into 65, 6, and 7. When I first sent it around to a few people, one of the persons said to me, gee, you created a fictitious university. Why didn't you just set this at the University of California, Berkeley, which is where the free speech movement was born? And I said, I could just envision a reviewer saying, that didn't happen that way. So I not only didn't put it at the University of California, Berkeley, I set it in New Mexico, and created a fictitious university. And by setting it in New Mexico, I enabled myself to bring in disparate kinds of people and communities that don't exist in Northern California. And this also was very helpful for me in the writing of the book.
Another important decision that you made in writing your books is that you've chosen to write under a pseudonym. And I'm not saying that to like out you and now I'm going to say your real identity. Like that's not what I'm here to do. But I do want to ask, what was behind that choice?
The issue came up about a year before I published My Mother's Son, when my publicist and my attorney were both doing searches for me. And my name is Frederick Price, and I proudly admit to that. And they did their searches, and they each came up with dozens and dozens of hits on Google as a biotech guy, all the press releases and all of the presentations that I've done. And what they said was, you're going to run into a problem. Because if you write as Frederick Price, people are going to do a search. And when they find a biotech guy, they're either going to say, I have the wrong person, and I don't know what to do because I've spelled it correctly. Or they'll say, oh my God, some other business guy just probably is writing anecdotes about what happened in business. And I didn't want that to happen. And they said, you really should change your name. I wasn't thrilled with that. But then the more we talked about it, the more logical it seemed. So what I did was I decided to select names that had meaning to me. And so the David is from my father-in-law, my late father-in-law, David Straker. And the Hirschberg is from my late grandfather on the maternal side. His name was Bill Hirschberg. And these were the two men who had the most profound effect on me as I was growing up. And I thought it was a nice way to honor them. And I make no bones about the fact of who I am. As a matter of fact, my Facebook account says David Hirschberg, parentheses, others know me as Frederick Price, the biotech guy. So I don't hide anything, but I do want to keep them segregated. I'm still involved in biotech. And of course, I'm still involved in writing, and I like to keep them in parallel.
I'm really interested in this. I didn't think we'd have a big thread, but now I'm just reflecting a little bit, because one piece that I reflect on, my name has changed. We talked about it a tiny bit on the show when it happened. When I got married in 2017, my name was Rofus, and that was my last name. And now my last name is Rofberg. And the Google point that you brought up is hitting me pretty hard, because to this day, every once in a while, I Google Lex Rofus or Alexander Rofus. That's another Easter egg. Not everybody knows my real name is Alexander. That's fun. But like, it's mostly stuff from up to like 2015, 2016. Every once in a while, there's a smattering of somebody who like quotes an article I wrote before my name changed. And I actually find it to be like a thoughtful, reflective exercise to do that and sort of see those two different people, Lex Rofus and Lex Rofberg, obviously not different people in the sense we mean, but there is a non-trivial way in which multiple selves in each of us can be real. I'm curious, have you started to experience a sense of having those multiple selves? Is there a way in which David Hirschberg is not, in fact, just a manufactured identity, but a real kind of person now?
The answer is yes, and it's surprising. When I make personal appearances, and now I can still consider Zoom a personal appearance, but when they were face-to-face up until a year or so ago, I would be introduced as David Hirschberg. It's a pseudonym. They'd give my real name. Every question from the audience was David. Absolutely everyone. No one ever used my given name. And I think it was done out of two reasons. One is respect, because I was there as David Hirschberg. But two, it's because I was David Hirschberg to them. I wasn't somebody else. I wasn't a biotech guy. I was an author. And as they're looking at a book, they see the name of the book and they see a novel by David Hirschberg and they see a picture and the picture's of me. They accept the fact that I've got a doppelganger. The interesting thing to me is that I think I'm a little bit different as David Hirschberg than I am with my given name. When I'm speaking as David Hirschberg, I'm speaking as a writer. And obviously my personality is the same, but there is something that's a little bit different. I actually do feel as if I'm David Hirschberg when I'm on a Zoom call to a book club.
Right.
15 minutes later, I could have a board meeting under my given name, and then I'm a slightly different person. And I start to see it. I did not think this was going to happen a few years ago, almost 4 years ago when I did this, but it has happened. Now, I don't want to push it too far to say I'm a completely different person.
Sure.
with split per. This is not, you know, the three phases of Eve. I am the same person, but there is a difference, and I have noticed it.
When I read your first book, My Mother's Son, I had spent many years living in Boston. And I read that book and I remember I had this conversation with you. I said, well, where did you grow up in Boston? You know, and you said, oh, no, I was like, I don't think you said I've never been to Boston, but it was pretty close to, you know, I haven't really spent much time in Boston. And I said, well, how did you know all the details about, you know, where things were and everything? Now, granted, this was, the book takes place in the 50s or something like that. So it could very well be that things changed from the time that I lived there in you know, the 80s and 90s. But it just felt, it had this feel of realness. And you said, no, I kind of like looked things up on Google Maps and I did a lot of research. And then this book, Jacobo's Rainbow, it takes place in like you said, in New Mexico. Now, having known that you didn't really come from Boston, I was reading it with some degree of kind of caution. You know, I didn't want to get too swept up into, but I also know that you do a tremendous amount of research. So I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about, first of all, why, you know, when you talk to people about writing fiction, they often will give you this kind of truism, right? Write what you know. So I imagine that there's part of what you're doing where you're writing what you know, but there's a lot of what you're doing where you're writing what you don't know. And how do you balance those two, and why do you balance those two? Like, why don't you write about where you actually grew up?
The only kind of research I do is the research that is factual, such as from my mother's son, as an example, if I was talking about the T, which is the public transportation system, I wanted to make sure that the red line went to the stops I said it did in 1952. That kind of research I did. When there's a scene in my mother's son with President Kennedy, when he gave the Ich bin ein Berliner speech in what was then West Berlin, I wanted to make sure that he was in front of the right city hall, and I got the right German name for that. But that's the only kind of research I do. People ask me, well, how do you know this? And I say, well, it's fiction. I don't know any of this. I make it up. So in Jacobo's Rainbow, yes, I did some research when I mentioned the kinds of flowers and trees and the color of the Rio Grande at certain places. Yes, that was all research, but that was trivial. And no one would have known if I did a different kind of oak or different kind of sagebrush, and nobody would criticize me for that, but I wanted to get that right. But I don't write about what I know. It's not as fresh as something that is truly novel, no pun intended. I would write something down and then I would leave it for a bit and come back to it. And I'd say, is this something that person would really say? Because I wanted to make sure it's not something I would have said. And in a Bronx cheer, so I've been to the Bronx because I've been to baseball games at Yankee Stadium and I've been to the Bronx Zoo and the Botanical Gardens, but that's about it. I wanted to make sure that everything was really different and unusual. And I didn't worry about the fact that would I get a specific street correct or incorrect in terms of what it looked like, because the book, A Bronx Cheer, takes place in 1955, and I'm sure many of the streets have changed and the buildings have come down.
One thing that we're always interested in, but especially in some of the conversations we're having with authors, is building the Jewish future, or the Jewish futures, or Judaism's moving forward. And one of our core premises of why we're having these conversations is that we believe, whether it's speculative fiction or any kind of fiction, that fiction in particular has a big role to play in the future of Judaism, of Judaism's. And I am curious, I figure you agree, you've invested a lot of your time in doing this, and you've done it specifically through fiction that one could term Jewish fiction. You could also term it other adjective fictions. Are we right? In what ways is that right? In what ways would you push us? Like, what role might fiction have to play specifically in the project of building new forms of Jewish practice, Jewish community in the future?
I would love to see more people who are writing about Jewish characters, Jewish stories, Jewish venues, not write about the Holocaust and not write coming to America in 1910. I would love more fiction to be of the kind that I thought, one of the books I thought was brilliant was Michael Chabon's The Yiddish Policeman's Union. because what he did was he created a false Jewish community in Alaska, which I thought was incredibly creative. And whether you liked the book or you didn't write the book, the gestalt of that book was really very, very innovative. I would like to see more of independent Jews, more regular Jews, write about things that are important to them that have to do with what's going on today in the Jewish world and what might be coming in the future in the Jewish world. Yes, I would like to see a nonfiction book about how Moshe House was created or how you guys decided to create Judaism Unbound. And those are good too. But from a novelist point of view, I want to see a lot of creativity about things that can stir up a conversation about what Judaism is going to be like. Because I think we all of us on who listen to this podcast believe that in 50 or 100 years, they'll look back and say, wow, this was a big inflection point, kind of the end of an era, or if not the end, a diminution of certain things that had gone on for 30 or 40 or 50 years, and we're now entering a new way to practice Judaism. I'd love there to be a lot more fiction writing about that.
So this isn't really a direction that I plan to go, but what you're talking about is raising this question for me, which is sort of the economics of being an author. One of the things that we've been struggling a lot lately on this show, actually, or probably from the very beginning, is this question of whether doing the kind of innovative Jewish living, you know, organizational creation, et cetera, is really something that, if it's going to be bold enough, can really be done as a profitable venture, you know, meaning that you're actually going to be able to make a living doing it. Or really, like when we look back at the early rabbis after the destruction of the temple, we see that a lot of them have a name, like Rabbi so-and-so the sandal maker, or Rabbi so-and-so the blacksmith. And that there was a reason for that, which was that when you're in this period of transition, there's this important work that has to be done, then by definition, there isn't necessarily a big enough market for it. And I'm connecting that to fiction because of what I asked earlier, which was that, like, I am desperate for this, you know, speculative fiction about the Jewish future that has not yet been written, and that I think because it hasn't been written, people can't quite picture it, and so they don't go along with Lex and me and as bold as we want to go, because we can picture it without the novel, but other people, it's harder. And so then part of me feels like, you know, well, I should write that novel. And then it's kind of like, oh, well, you know, how many people are really going to buy it? And, you know, I'm not going to make any money from writing the novel. And so I guess the question is kind of how do you think about that part of it? Or do you think that there actually is in the genre of Jewish fiction, because Jews read a lot of books, that there actually are enough Jews reading books that it's a reasonable way to spend one's time from a income generating point of view?
The answer to that has a lot to do with a comment that was made to me about 2 years ago when I was out on the road with my mother's son. And somebody from the audience made a statement. They said, well, you don't make any money selling these books. And the answer was, you're correct. I don't make any money selling the books. And so then the follow-up questions have to do with, well, now I see why you waited these 50 years to write, because you had to do some income generation from drug development in order to be able to have the freedom and the luxury to travel and to write. My kids asked me why I didn't start to write earlier. And I said, summer camp, braces, private school, college, graduate school, you get the picture. It's very difficult to make money writing novels unless you're one of the few that gets, perhaps it's lucky enough to get picked up by a very big press and get promoted a lot. You know, if you're Barack Obama and you put out a nonfiction book, the number of copies that's printed prior to publication is probably 5 or 10 million. For a debut novelist, it can be 2 or 3,000. More than half of the books that I sell are ebooks, which is also part of the future, I believe, audiobooks and ebooks. But it's very difficult to simply stop when you have a lot of financial obligations and say, I'm not going to write, because the implications of that are, if you're not successful, you can have some severe financial and other kinds of stress. I'm hoping that perhaps there are some of the younger people who don't have the huge financial burden overhanging them, who can sit down and write. The counterpoint to that is, if you're 25, you don't have a whole lot of living experience, and there may not be things that you can pick up on for a novel. And generally, not exclusively, but generally, most of the people who are very young write about things they know or about things that have to do with their life. So it's a delicate balance as to how to do this and when to do this. And I'm not so sure that it's going to be very easy. I'm hoping that now that many people are not going to go back to a physical office, that they'll have more time in their house and do more Zoom and other Teams calls. Don't want to give a plug to one without giving a plug to the other. That maybe there'll be more time to do this, and perhaps there'll be a little less time that people will give to the kinds of hobbies that say, I'm going to go skiing for 2 weeks. Maybe I ought to sit down in an Aerie on the third floor and write a little bit. And I can't criticize anybody for not writing, because I didn't write for 50 years. I wanted to take care of my family first.
I want to sit with this because, you know, here we are. We like to be sort of we like to have a revolutionary kind of bent on this podcast. And I'm finding that I both agree with the economics question, with how you both are talking about the economics question, and I kind of want to push on it, because, like, I want to look at this reality, which is in fact a reality, that people don't have the ability to set aside their lives to write unless they come from certain kinds of privileges. Like, that's true. What would it look like for us to upend that? A, as a society, and B, if we can't do it as a whole society immediately, what would it look like to do that within Jewish life? There are big Jewish institutions that have budget lines for different things. It could be. I'm not saying this goes to what you said when you were talking to your biotech folks. Like, I don't know that this is my game plan for the Jewish future, but just to look at it from a different angle, like, it could be that people said, we are going to set aside a massive budget line, and we are going to give people who can't afford it, specifically people who don't come from that privilege, we're gonna give them money, and they're gonna write Jewish books, and they're gonna make a living off that, because we believe that the Jewish future needs those books. And so the money that would have gone to whatever staff people, to whatever, I don't know, to whatever else, we're going to put it towards this because it's that important. And, like, is that a stretch? Is that something I think is going to happen tomorrow? No. But I think if we really believed that this set of books, that this future world of beautiful speculative fiction across future-looking speculative fiction and historical fiction and all of it, like, if we really thought that was, like, the thing for the Jewish future, I think we would find a way to do that. And so I'm curious, like, should we do that? Could we think about not just the current reality of those economics, but actually what it would mean to think beyond that?
The answer is yes and no. So the yes part is that it's a wonderful idea. And I think there are some innovative institutions that would, in fact, set aside money as grants to give to people of whatever age, if they've submitted something in terms of a 1, 2, 3-pager that demonstrates their high quality of writing, let's say a novel, I think there would be a demand for that. The supply side of that, which is the no side, is who is going to spend the time to read, to criticize, to edit, and then to do all the other work that's necessary in order to get a book published. So the input side, I think, is a great idea. The output side, I think, is going to be very difficult, because the big five publishers aren't going to have any motivation to do that, because it sucks up so much time and energy and cost away from doing what they're doing. The smaller independent publishers don't have the wherewithal to do that. So it's going to have to be kind of a one-off thing until it starts to build momentum. And you see what happens. It's like, you know, the first few rotations of the wheel, they're slow, and then gravity takes hold if it's downhill and it goes faster and faster. I think it's going to be something like that, that the idea is terrific, but the reality of making it happen is very, very difficult, especially because there is not a lot of money other than in the blockbusters, the famous authors plus the politicians or celebrities. Other than those people, it's very, very hard to make any money on selling books. So it will take time. Now, is the answer, don't print the books, just do them from PDFs and have them read as audiobooks. Cuts the cost way, way down, and the distribution and the inventory. And so maybe it's, you know, some cover art, and but you still have to have a really good editor and a copy editor and a proofreader. And so there is some cost. I think it's an idea that should be pushed and maybe broached with some of the innovative people who are interested in the next Jewish generation or future. And I think maybe some testing ought to be done in that to see if it's viable.
So before we close, I wanted to give you a chance just to talk a little bit about Jacobo's Rainbow, and in particular, its Jewishness. In particular, I'm always cautious to not give away any spoilers, and how do you also, you know, talk about a really interesting book? But maybe if you could just talk a little bit about some of the features in this book about Jewish identity in particular, and about maybe the hiddenness and the openness of Jewish identity, would just be very interesting as a cliffhanger for folks to then go on and look at the book.
So there are three main characters in the book, and one represents a Sephardic, one represents Ashkenazic, and one Mizrahi. And they all bring their backgrounds to the fore in the book at certain points in time. At the outset, a lot of it is hidden. You don't know who's what, although one character, clearly the Ashkenazic character, I can say that, is just out there very much. You recognize him. He makes no bones about the fact that he's a European Jew. But the others, it takes a while to understand what's going on and how they reveal themselves and why they reveal themselves. And that has a lot to do with Jewish identity, a lot to do with anti-Semitism, a lot to do with not rocking the boat. And it is how they come to grips with this and then how they change. And at a certain point in time, there's an inflection point where they basically, I'm not saying they throw away their past, but they build on their past now with confidence and say, I'm ready to go out there into the Jewish world and behave in a way that I'm neither ashamed of, nor do I need to keep hidden. The book isn't exclusively related to Jews. There's a lot about the Vietnam War, and there's a particularly gruesome chapter of some terrible atrocities and problems in Vietnam.
A quick content warning, there's some graphic descriptions of violence here. If you would like to fast forward, a minute will suffice, a minute forward from now.
I think war is sanitized a lot. We're so distant from the wars in Afghanistan and where there are troops in Iraq and Syria and even in Central Africa. And I think that war is hell, and people have to see that and understand it. I'm not suggesting I'm against all wars at all times, or that's not the point, but to understand the implications of what happens in war. And I will give one spoiler. In Vietnam, there is a scene in which American soldiers get massacred. And and Jacobo sees this. And he also notes that after the VC have shot the men in his platoon, they then go up to each American and put a bullet in their head. Later on, when the tides have turned and changed, Jacobo refrains from doing that. He could easily do that when it's his turn, and he doesn't do it. And there's the last part of that scene in Vietnam is that as he's searching the soldiers, according to convention, he's probably looking for private military papers. And instead, he finds pictures of the man's family and children.
So in closing, as you were describing this, and also I think it's you were talking about the people who's, you know, are feeling comfortable to come out to the world in their Jewish identity, it made me think about what you said about your own upbringing. And I wonder two things. Like, one, is there an element there that you are writing what you know in that dimension in particular? And more deeply, the question that I was thinking about as you were talking is, would that Fred of 50 years ago, would that person have been able to read these books? Is that something that you pay a lot of attention to make sure that your own writing now is accessible to the you of 50 years ago? Or is that something that's just too hard to do as somebody for whom all that time has passed?
I do think there's, without being anything specific, that there is a part of the Jewishness that I embraced when I met my wife and became active in the Jewish community. I think there is some of that in the book. I don't know that there. I can point to a specific sentence or paragraph in any of the books, but clearly it's my comfort zone. And so it allows me to write about different kinds of Jews under different kinds of circumstances, whether they be stressful or not stressful. I think that's pretty clear. And with respect to your second question, I've actually addressed this in a way in which I have reread many of the books that I read when I was in college in the maybe 10 years after that. I'm involved with two Jewish groups in which we read an enormous number of books. And in one of the groups, we have specifically gone back to some of the classic books from 50 and 75 years ago and reread them. And although I remembered reading a paragraph or a chapter, and I said, oh, I know this character, and I know exactly what's going to happen, my whole perspective on the book is changed remarkably. Because I'm older, because I've experienced many new things, because I'm also a more sophisticated reader, and because I'm also a writer now. And I like doing that. We have basically reread everything from Hemingway that we read in college and afterwards, and so many others as well. We recently reread The Great Gatsby. And there's a scene in The Great Gatsby which is so anti-Semitic that I remembered reading it, but it never registered with me when I first read that in college. And now I'm reading it and my blood is boiling. I know what was going on. And now I understand why it was there. And I'm not so sure it was intended solely to be an anti-Semitic thing. It probably did reflect some of the activities that were around at the time in the 1920s. But I have done that. I have gone back. So the question you're really asking is, in 50 years, will people go back and read my three books and say they're anachronisms, or are they relevant, or do they sing to me? I hope so. I won't know. God give me another 50 years and I'll be able to tell you.
Thank you so much, David Hirschberg, for joining us. This has been a fantastic conversation.
I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you guys, and I wish you the best in developing the next generation of the Jewish future.
What's your question?
What's your question?
Well, I was just wondering,
where did you realize?
Where was the first time that you
are patron trying? Questions from Judaism Unbound listeners. Welcome to Patron Questions. As promised at the top of this show, Dan mentioned that we're going to have the voices of our listeners appearing on the show, and that is the truth. We have our first question today, and just to lay the context for the future, we're going to be having these questions, not every episode, but every here and there, where we encourage our patrons, folks who support us on a $5 a month basis or more, to send in your own questions, get your own voices on the air. We are thrilled to start hearing directly from you on the show. For a long time, we've been encouraging you to be in touch with us with messages, emails, all that good stuff, and we still encourage that. But if you want to have your voice on Judaism Unbound itself, you can, And all you got to do is you have to be a patron and then send us in a question. So if you want to become our second or our third or a future patron question, just head to judaismunbound.com/donate and become a patron. Or if you already are one, just send us an email and let us know what you want to ask about. So, listener, our first ever patron, what is your question?
Hi, my name's Sydney Kushner. I'm a monthly donor from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And my question is, what is a moment when you realized you wanted to pursue a career in Jewish thought?
This is a great model because this question gets at, you know, a little bit of a personal window into, in this case, my life. Dan will be answering future questions, but it also, I think, opens up some broader questions. So let's dive in. Okay, when was a moment that I realized I wanted to go into a career in Jewish thought? That's like a great question because I'll reflect on all the way back in high school. I did have some inclination that like maybe if my career going into math didn't work out, like that could be an interesting alternative plan. I was really into math, still am. But I had a meeting with a local Jewish Federation leader and I went in and we talked about different organizations, all that good stuff. And I asked him a question. I was like, is there a way for somebody to not quite work for any one particular Jewish organization, but kind of be thinking about all of them and like looking at how the pieces fit together and how that goes? And his response was very quick. And it was, no, not really. You have to work for one particular organization, which, you know, true. There's not really anything out there for you to be just sort of thinking about how the pieces fit together between different organizations. And what's funny is years later, that's kind of what Judaism Unbound has figured out a way to do. Like we do get to feature all these different voices from around the country or occasionally the world and think about how those pieces of Jewish life today fit together and also don't fit together. So that moment has been one that sat with me. On that Jewish thought frame, I haven't thought about that phrase before so much with us. I mean, I hear it in like college classes, like modern Jewish thought, and then you read philosophers or whatever. I don't know if we're doing that or if we're not doing that. I do love that at the very least we're thinking out loud. And I hope doing something for y'all out there listening where whether or not we're doing Jewish thought, we're inviting you into Jewish thinking as well. So I guess, you know, maybe we should wear that Jewish thought label with pride. I'll have to see how that fits. I'll have to try that out moving forward. But thanks for the question. It's a great one. With that, we're going to close this episode out. We love this closing note of a question. We once again want to encourage you, if you'd like to submit a question for the future, we'll talk you through the logistics, all that stuff. But basically, if you're a patron and if you email us, that's how you do it. So judaismunbound.com/donate. That is the route to go to become a patron. And once you have done that, you can contact us at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. Thank you, Sydney, for kicking us off. So we will close out by mentioning the other ways you can be in touch with us. There are our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter handles. All of those are @judaismunbound. And you can head to our website, judaismunbound.com. One thing to mention is that Shavuot Live, our 30-hour festival digitally of Jewish learning, is coming up soon on May 16th through 17th. We would love to see you there, and there's more information about that at jewishlive.org/Shavuot. That's S-H-A-V-U-O-T. That's our last little note. We hope that this episode resonated for you. We hope you enjoyed this first patron question. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.